The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight, with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, welcome to a Wednesday. I am Nicole Sandler, coming to you live at NicoleSandler.com and through the magic of digital audio on the Progressive Voices Network, now heard Tuesdays through Fridays at 6 p.m. Eastern. So yesterday, there I was at the Broward County Courthouse. I had jury duty, so sorry I was not here. Thankfully for me, I did not get picked to be on this jury that I was part of voir dire for. I think that's the right use of the term. It was a civil suit. It had to do with a car accident, car meets van kind of thing. And they said it was going to take all week. So all of a sudden, my stomach starts doing flip-flops because I figure if it's going to take all week, then I'm really screwed because I can't be here. And as you know, I do everything myself. It's a one-woman show around here. So thankfully, they saw my hardship and were lenient in my direction. So I'm off the hook for another year anyway. I have nothing against serving jury duty. If I had a regular job where I got paid, to be there, I'd have no problem. Or if I even had somebody who could fill in for me, I think it is our civic responsibility. But it wouldn't be fair to you, and it wouldn't be fair to what I'm trying to put together here. So thankfully, I'm here. But the whole first half of the day, I was sitting in the big jury room waiting for them to call my number. Sure enough, I'm constantly checking the phone and reading emails and reading a little bit of the book that our guest will be here today to discuss. It's called The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. It is Women's History Month, after all. And I'll get to that in a few minutes. The fact that movements matter, protests help, and you can change the world with enough dedicated people. As the suffragists proved 100 years ago, and as today's high school kids are proving as well. The news yesterday, maybe we'll get into this a little later because our guest is coming up early today. The news that came across my phone yesterday as I'm sitting in jury duty is Rex Tillerson is out. And it's, all I could think is it figures, right? Day that I'm out, big news breaks. And, we find out that Mike Pompeo, who is now the head of the CIA, will likely be the successor to Rex Tillerson at the Department of State. Really, Rex Tillerson was wholly unqualified for the position, but then again, so is Mike Pompeo. Secretary of State is all about diplomacy and negotiating, and Mike Pompeo is a graduate of West Point and a Tea Partier. He's all about war. This man wants war with Iran, period. He thought the Iraq war was a great idea. He's not the kind of guy we want in there, but, such is life, right? This is what we're learning. Anyway, today, what's going on today is the National School Walkout Day. And the kids at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School here in Parkland, 10 minutes from my house, they got the ball rolling on this. And it's, I was watching a bit of TV earlier, watching all over the country where these walkouts are taking place. Here's one. This is in Washington, D.C. Kids from surrounding areas all went over and marched outside the White House, where they turned their backs on the White House and sat, I believe, for 17 minutes of silence, 1 minute for each of the people that was killed 1 month ago today at Douglas High in Parkland. So sad. But here's one of the kids who got up to the microphone that I thought was just so eloquent out of so many of them.
I want all of you to know that you're all on the right side of history for this. Now, personally, I'm glad to take part in a powerful nationwide movement like the one that we're participating in today. But we can all agree, in an ideal world, none of us would be here. In an ideal world, the 20 first graders and kindergartners who died in Sandy Hook would be in middle school today. In an ideal world, the 58 concert goers who were gunned down in Las Vegas would have gone home and returned to be with their families. In an ideal world, the 32 students who died at Virginia Tech would be employed professionals, and the 17 victims from Stoneman Douglas would probably be eating lunch at school right now, and the only thing they'd be worrying about was a test for next period. But unfortunately, this isn't the case. Unfortunately, we live in a country where lawmakers are more concerned about their contributions from the NRA than they are about the lives of their own constituents.
Yeah, this is far from a perfect world. In a perfect world, we wouldn't have to be talking about this. In a perfect world, we wouldn't have to be screaming about the necessity for an assault weapons ban. You know, we had one for 10 years. Unfortunately, the way it was written into law, it was allowed to expire after 10 years. If they had just kept that law on the books, there'd be a lot more people who would not have gotten killed in these mass shootings. But such is the hand we've been dealt. But I was talking about movements, and I believe these kids really are, you know, they're on the cusp of adulthood. Some of them have already turned 18. Others are turning 18 this year and next year. And this is a mission that these kids will be on for the rest of their lives. They will be spreading the gospel at whatever colleges they may go to, whatever jobs they may hold, to their family members. And they're focused, they're laser focused on voting. At a lot of these events, they have registration booths set up. And like here in Florida, you can pre-register to vote, I believe, at the age of 16, even though obviously you're not registered. You can't vote until you're 18. You can pre-register as soon as you get your driver's license. And it's the motor voter law. So these kids do give me hope. And seeing, I couldn't turn away from the TV. For once, it was encouragement that was keeping me glued to the box this morning. Seeing all these, and the way it worked is at 10 o'clock in whatever time zone the schools were at, the kids were going to do a walkout. So it started here on the East Coast. At 10 o'clock, there was a big one at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. And actually, in some surrounding schools, actually marched. They left earlier and marched up to Douglas. There are a number of high schools in our area. Douglas is one of four high schools that serve this Coral Springs, Parkland area that I live in. That's not the school my daughter went to. She went to Coral Glades High School. But there is Coral Springs High School and another one called Terra Nova, I think. I'm drawing a blank on the name of it. But there's four of these schools serving a pretty compact area of a lot of people. So everywhere you go in this neck of the woods, you can see the effects of you know, a nation, of a community that was hurt. There was one of the women on the panel that the jury was selected from yesterday. Her kid goes to Douglas, and I think she was excused because I think the judge thought she should be home for when her kid gets home from school. That's my speculation of why she was excused. Bottom line is she was not put on the jury. So anyway, while that's going on, that is a movement. That is something that I believe will keep Terra Vella. Thank you, Trip. Boy, what was I don't know. I said Terra Nova. Terra Vella is the other high school in the area. Oh, yes. My brain is still a foggy mess. All right. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a quick time out. We'll get what's news, get caught up on what all happened yesterday. And then we're going to come back and speak with Elaine Weiss, author of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. And then I'll have a few more words to say at the end of the interview about some of the exodus movement of the people, man, going on out of the White House. All that's coming up on today's show. I'm Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The president on Tuesday ousted his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, via Twitter. Trump plans to nominate CIA Director Mike Pompeo to replace Tillerson as the nation's top diplomat. In a farewell address, Tillerson thanked career diplomats for their honesty and integrity and the American people for acts of kindness. He singled out Defense Secretary Jim Mattis for their partnership and mutual support of diplomacy. He notably did not thank Trump or praise his policies. He did, however, call out Russia.
Much work remains to establish a clear view of the nature of our future relationship with China. How shall we deal with one another over the next 50 years? And ensure a period of prosperity for all of our peoples, free of conflict between two very powerful nations. And much work remains to respond to the troubling behavior and actions on the part of the Russian government. Russia must assess carefully as to how its actions are in the best interest of the Russian people and of the world more broadly. Continuing on their current trajectory is likely to lead to greater isolation on their part, a situation which is not in anyone's interest.
The Republicans who control the House Intelligence Committee reached a verdict that there was no evidence of collusion, coordination, or conspiracy between Donald Trump's campaign and the Russian government during the 2016 election, and on Monday evening announced they were ending their investigation. On Tuesday, Ranking Member Adam Schiff announced the Democrats on the committee were releasing their own status report that laid out their case to continue the probe.
We are releasing this evening a 22-page status report on the investigation that sets out some of the key witnesses that the majority has been unwilling to bring in, the key documents they have been unwilling to ask for, the witnesses who have come before our committee and stonewalled on key questions, so that the public can see just how incomplete this effort was. Sadly, from a very early point in the investigation, the chairman made the decision that his mission was not to find out what Russia did, not to determine the role of U.S. persons, but rather to endeavor to distract the public, to put the government on trial. That problem persisted throughout our investigation and has led to its premature conclusion last night. But the work is too important to leave undone. In particular, the American people need to know whether the Russians still have something they can hold over the president's head, the president of the United States. So our work is far from done. And we will be submitting to the public a detailed account of what we have learned to date and the work that has to be done, if not by us, then by others, so that the country can be sure that its administration is acting in the best interest of the country and not because of leverage the Russians may have over the president of the United States.
On Tuesday, Donald Trump paid his first visit as president to California. He went to San Diego to examine prototypes for his border wall.
We're looking very much at the wall with some see-through capability on the other side and then solid concrete on top, or steel and concrete on top. The round piece that you see up here, or you see more clearly back there, the larger it is, the better it is, because it's very hard to get over the top. It's really deterrent from getting over the top. Who would think? But getting over the top is easy. These are like professional mountain climbers. They're incredible climbers. They can't climb some of these walls. Some of them they can. Those are the walls we're not using.
Trump also went to a fundraiser in Beverly Hills Tuesday night. On Wednesday morning, Connor Lamb was declared the apparent winner in the special election for Pennsylvania's 18th congressional district after the absentee ballots from Washington County were counted.
We are now declaring Connor Lamb, the Democrat, the apparent winner here in the 18th district of Pennsylvania. Basically, what you're looking at here is a 141 vote margin currently for Lamb district wide. And the reason he's just been declared the apparent winner in the last few minutes by NBC News has to do with Washington County. This is a Republican county. Traditionally, we waited and waited and waited and waited all night to get the absentee ballots from Washington County. We finally did. And what you actually saw here was that Connor Lamb won the absentee count in this district by 62 votes, plus 62 for Lamb. Again, that continued a trend we've been seeing, the absentees favoring Lamb. It was Saccone's last sort of gasp hope in this thing. If you get a big number in the absentees, maybe he could have cut into Lamb's lead. What we're down to now here, and so far the Saccone campaign, we have to say they have not conceded as of this moment. What we're down to here and why we start getting into this apparent winner declaration is today still they will count the absentee ballots in Greene County, by far the smallest population in the district. And then beyond that, we're going to have military votes. I don't know, maybe about 75 of those, and provisional ballots. Low hundreds we're talking here.
On Wednesday, 1 month after the mass shooting at Parkland, Florida's Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, students across the country are walking out of their classrooms to protest gun violence. The national school walkout was scheduled to begin at 10 a.m. in every time zone and last for 17 minutes, a minute for each life lost in the shooting. Stephen Hawking, one of the most influential physicists of our time, has died at the age of 76. Since his early 20s, Hawking had lived with ALS. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener-funded, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
These are the sounds of crushed souls, the sounds of despair from former radio personalities languishing in the purgatory of corporate consolidation. These former radio personalities have lost their livelihoods, not because they weren't entertaining or informative, but because they don't meet today's corporate terrestrial broadcast standards of being smelly, overweight douchebags, seething with vein-popping hatred. These radio refugees and their audiences have since migrated to the internet, but their struggle continues as the quest for monetization ensues. Nicole Sandler is leading the way to reestablishing thought-provoking and entertaining radio, and you can help by clicking the donate button on NicoleSandler.com. Donate today, or as much and as often as you can. Dry the tears of listeners by removing the rotting stench of corporate radio. Won't you help?
Well, our guest is not here yet. This is why I usually give you part of the inner workings of the way things go around here. you know, it's a one-woman show. I work without a producer. Even so, I usually ask to call the guest so that we don't run into an incident like this where I come back from the break and the guest is not there. And today, because the book is brand new, it's called The Woman's Hour. It was just published a week ago, and she's up at the publisher's office today, I guess, doing a bunch of interviews from their offices. And they were supposed to call in at 3:15. It's now 3:18, and we haven't heard from them yet. So I'll tell you a little bit about the book and see if she does call in. Basically, this is the story of how women won the right to vote, the final battle over the 19th Amendment. And it's a fight that went on for over 70 years, 70 years. So the people who were instrumental in getting the fight started, the ones that Amy Simon told us about on Friday, the Susan B. Anthony's and Katie B. Stanton's of the world, they weren't even alive to see the women get the vote. It had already happened. I mean, they had already died by the time the year 1920 rolled around. And it was in August of 1920 that women finally got the right to vote. And it was hard fought. There were a number of factions of women who either fought for it or fought against it. And see, this is why I do interviews, because I can ask the questions rather than tell you the stories. I'll tell you what, we'll wait for Elaine Weiss to hopefully call in. Let's see if she does. In the meantime, let's get on with a bit more of what happened in the news, shall we? Because not only was Rex Tillerson, you know what, and I'm going to open the phone lines too, should you care to weigh in on anything, because it may just be us today. 954-889-6410 is the phone number. You can also Skype in to Nicole Sandler. If you've got anything you'd like to, oh, hold on. Oh, great. She said, oh, she's having a hard time finding her author. She's supposed to be doing the call from their offices. This really sucks. Now I'm playing producer. I'm just writing a letter to them. All right. Anyway, all right. So Rachel Maddow, you know, she's got that big board that she goes to. I don't watch Rachel Maddow all that often these days, just because something about her style. The way she'll repeat something over and over again, like she's talking down to the audience, but she has good information, and she's got this big board of all the people who have left the administration or have been fired. And it started out as one column and then it went to two. And now last night she finished up the third column because she had to add on. It wasn't only Rex Tillerson who exited the White House yesterday. And she had to add on a few more names since the last time she updated the big board. So I'll tell you what, let's go to Rachel Maddow and find out about some of the latest people who hit the road from the White House.
We had to add Hope Hicks when she resigned as communications director.
Yes.
We had to add Josh Rafel when he resigned as deputy communications director, the one who worked for Jared and Ivanka. Then we had Jared and Ivanka's other friend, the guy who Trump had put in charge of the Office of American Innovation, that guy Reed Cordish, he was out too in the last couple of weeks. Then we had to add the number two official at the Homeland Security Department, Elaine Duke. Then we had to add the top official in the whole U.S. government on North Korea policy. His last day in the administration after 30 years working on this issue was the Friday before Trump announced, surprise, he's going to meet with the dictator of North Korea. Yeah, who needs a specialist on North Korea policy anymore? Then we had the ambassador to Mexico also announced that she was leaving, another 30 plus years in the Foreign Service. She was not invited to the meetings that Jared Kushner took when he went to Mexico last week. And then we had Gary Cohn, the White House chief economic advisor, also leaving as well. So we've had to develop this whole new system of trying to keep this list all in one place. Now tonight we've got to squeeze things even a little bit more, because now we've got to add in, drum roll please, the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who apparently came back early from a trip to Africa.
And we'll come back to that, because I think we might have Elaine Weiss on the line. Elaine, is that you?
Yes, it is.
Ah, a little late, but I guess late is better than never. Thank you for calling.
I'm very glad to be with you.
So, as I was telling the listeners, Elaine Weiss is the author of a brand new book. It's called The Women's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. And this is National Women's History Month, so a good time for you to release the book.
Yes, it is.
Now, you had originally planned on releasing the book. You turned in the manuscript right on election eve or something, didn't you?
Yes, I finished the manuscript on the Monday before Election Day, November 2016. But it's right on time for being published, but I did finish it then. I think I had a different outcome in the back of my mind, but I was writing a history that I knew was going to resonate in terms of its historical value. I think I didn't realize how much contemporary resonance it was going to have.
There are a lot of, I was talking about how today is National School Walkout Day, and how movements mm-hmm. matter, and how when people feel strongly enough about an issue and they do they put their minds, bodies, and hearts into it, they can change the world. This is what happened back almost 100 years ago with these women and with the help of some men who fought for women's right to vote. Do you see parallels between different movements and different eras?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the movement towards suffrage and women's rights begins 175 years ago. It's 100 years ago, almost 100 years ago, that we win the vote. But before that, women were agitating for the vote for 72 years before. And it's remarkable. These were just ordinary women. These were not well-born, wealthy women. These were school teachers. Susan B. Anthony is a school teacher. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Cady Stanton's a housewife. And these are women who just see a wrong, see injustice, and organize and agitate to remedy it. And they bring in like-minded women first around literally a coffee table, and then in meetings all around the country, and slowly, slowly it builds. But this is grassroots activism at its most fundamental, and I think we see a lot of lessons to be learned today. And you know, watching what's been happening today with the school walkout, it's very much the way the movement began in the mid-19th century, when it was considered absolutely inappropriate for women to even speak in public. They were not supposed to speak in public at all.
Wow.
And they risked great, they were pelted with rotten eggs, with rotten vegetables. Susan Anthony used to say she could tell the progress of the movement when the things that were hurled at her became more benign, weren't as awful as they'd been at the beginning. So they went through a great deal of criticism and contempt and ridicule and physical assault. And they were assaulted by mobs of men who were just incensed about this.
But it wasn't only men, right? It wasn't only men that were fighting them. In fact, one of the bigger factions of the opposition to women's suffrage was women.
Yes, correct. It's not women who were physically attacking them. That tends to be the men.
Okay.
But yes, one of the most surprising things for me was to find that, especially in the last decade or two of the movement, the most vociferous opponents of women's suffrage, and especially the 19th Amendment, turns out to be women. It's women who are, for a variety of reasons, don't want women to get the vote. Some see it in interesting political terms. They think that if women are, as they call it, sullied by entering politics, that they'll lose some of the soft suasion, the sort of informal persuasive power they have of being above the fray, you know, have this moral purity of not being a political animal. And so in fact, they have some point in that during the progressive era, women did not have the vote, but were able to get some very important legislation pushed through. Other women opponents, are conservative women culturally, religiously, socially, and they see women's entering into the public sphere, entering into politics, even just as voters, even as citizens, they see that as the possible downfall of the family and of American society. I mean, they say that outright.
Wow.
That they see this as the first part of a slippery slope that will then send women into the workplace and into the wider world, and that's not her place. Her place is in the home. And we've heard echoes of that throughout the 20th century and 21st.
Sure. There were still some people. There's a program on Viceland TV. It's called The United States of Hate or something like that. And yesterday we were watching an episode where speaking with a woman who is an anti-feminist in today's world, mm-hmm. saying that women mm-hmm. should not have the right to vote. So there are always going to be those kinds of people out there. You got to wonder what you know, the sun looks like on their planet. This was a different thing. And it wasn't only the reasons you mentioned, but racism had a lot to do with the reasons that they didn't want to give women the vote, right?
Yes, it did. And it was sort of heartbreaking and shocking to see this. But of course, we're confronting it again today. One of the main reasons, especially in the southern states, is that if the 19th Amendment passes, which grants the vote to all women citizens, and that would be in all states for all elections, they, in the southern states, one of the fears is that this would allow black women to vote too. And while black men have the vote legally since after the Civil War, they have been essentially disenfranchised already by 1920 by Jim Crow laws, by intimidation, lynching, onerous ID and literacy tests and poll taxes and physical intimidation. So black men are prevented from voting. And the southern states don't want to deal with black women, too. And so that becomes a very explicit argument in the ratification fight that I detail in the Woman's Hour. And it becomes very ugly. And there are southern legislators who get up and say, this is a white nation and we have to protect white supremacy. And to hear that again in America almost 100 years later is really chilling.
You know, there's that old saying, history repeats itself. And in so many ways, we are seeing so much of this. We may not have literal poll taxes, but there are poll taxes in some of the voter ID laws. There is certainly voter intimidation and voter suppression going on. There's a lot of the same stuff. And as you mentioned, in the book, who was running for president during the time? Warren Harding.
Warren G. Harding.
And he ran on, he promised a return to normalcy, and he ran on the slogan, America First. That was just chilling to the bone.
Well, I'll tell you another interesting part of it is he is, again, running as the Republican nominee. He wants to bring the country back into a less progressive era, and he does manage to do that eventually. But he also, at the time of the election, is he's known to be a womanizer. He is being blackmailed by one of his mistresses, and he's had to pay hush money to keep her silent during the campaign.
Wow. History does repeat itself. And how did that turn out?
He wins.
Uh-oh. But we survived and got the 19th Amendment through, so I guess that's a glimmer of hope there.
I hope so. I hope so. He dies in office.
Oh, well, that's encouraging. Just saying. We're speaking with Elaine Weiss. She's the author of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. It was a fight. Some people talk about when women got the vote. Women didn't get the vote. Women fought for the vote. And
absolutely,
as you mentioned, this went on for over seven decades. And most when we think about the fight for the 19th Amendment, most people think of Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, some of the names you mentioned. But those efforts came earlier than the final battle you focus on. This book really focuses on the end, when it all came down to Tennessee, of all places. Why Tennessee?
Yeah, the women have been fighting for the vote for 72 years by this point. And it's gone on for three generations of women. And what's so interesting is that each generation grooms and trains the next. And I think that's a really interesting lesson for activists today. There's a very conscious grooming and educating and tutoring the next generation and getting them ready to assume leadership. It doesn't happen haphazardly at all. And I think we forget about that. So it comes to Tennessee because the federal amendment. So there are two ways for suffrage to be granted in according to the Constitution. One is the states actually are in control of the, their voting laws, which we see now because some states want to restrict voting.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be gotten state by state, and there are a few states that where women can vote. Wyoming is the first, pretty famously. Utah. By 1920, California women have the vote. New York women have the vote by referendum, where, of course, only men could decide whether women deserve the vote. So where they've been able to convince the male electorate that they deserve the vote by justice, by being citizens of equal stature, those women actually can vote already. But the only way the suffragists know that almost all the other states are going to be able to be forced to give their women suffrage is through a constitutional amendment. So that constitutional amendment is written by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, introduced into Congress in 1878, and is ignored for 40 years. It sits there for 40 years.
Wow.
Finally, they get it out. It finally gets passed, and I talk about in the book what it took to get it out of Congress, and it's not pretty, but it does happen. And it goes to the states, and it has to be ratified by 3/4 of the states. And there are 48 states in the Union at that time. That means 36 states have to ratify. By the summer of 1920, 35 have ratified, and they just need one more, and it'll become the law of the land. But there are 12 states that have already either rejected the amendment, most of them in the South, but even a place like Delaware, a state like Delaware, has rejected it.
Mm.
And there are several more states that are refusing to consider it for political reasons. They're under a lot of political pressure from donors, from corporations, from other sorts of pressure tactics. And they're not going to deal with it. They refuse to call their legislatures to consider it. So Tennessee becomes the last best hope for the suffragists to get this through. And what they see coming, and they're very accurate in that, the nation is starting to swing to the right. It's becoming much more reactionary. We're coming out of an unpopular war, which was World War I. There's a sense that we don't want to be involved in foreign entanglements. Does this sound familiar? And it's a time when we're being asked to join the League of Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a time, and we actually do not join the League of Nations, and that is Warren Harding's stance, and he wins. And so the suffragists see that if they don't get it now, it may not happen, because the mood of the nation is swinging to a much more reactionary phase, and that happens. 1920s we think of as, you know, flappers and
right.
and all kinds of things. No, it's actually politically very conservative, and they see that happening. So it comes to Tennessee. It's not the best place for the suffragists. It's a southern state. There's all kinds of pressures for states' rights, and there's the racial aspect, which is very strong in Tennessee, but they have no choice. They have to duke it out there.
Now, you had the suffragists, who were known as the Suffs, and then you had the Antis, which is the group that were working against them. And it really came down to a war between the two factions, right?
Yes.
So who were the Antis and who were the Suffs? Who were some of the characters that maybe whose names we don't know as well as Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton?
Exactly. Well, the suffragists are led now. The suffragists are actually split at this point. You know, we think it's something new for women's organizations to have differing ideas of how to proceed. It's nothing new. The suffrage movement is now split into at least two factions, one of them led by Carrie Chapman Catt, who is the mainstream leader of the movement. She's the sort of Martin Luther King, if you will, the more mainstream, I won't say conservative, but the one that is acknowledged as a leader. Then there's Alice Paul, who is much more radical and is willing to take action, direct action, as she calls it. She's trained in England with the Pankhursts. She's ready, and she does. They pick at, her people pick at the White House, are arrested. They're the ones who are tortured in prison. Mm. And both of those strands come to Tennessee. Carrie Chapman Catt comes from headquarters in New York and spends all 6 weeks there directing the strategy for her camp. A young suffragist named Sue White comes down to represent Alice Paul, and they have separate headquarters, but they're working towards the same goal. And then there's the anti-suffragists. There are the local ones in Tennessee, and they're led by a local Tennessee woman named Josephine Pearson. But then there are also the national anti-suffragists who come to Tennessee. The women, there's a spokeswoman who comes from New York, who is a master debater, and she has a lacerating tongue. And she comes down to just excoriate the whole movement. And it's very, very colorful what she, how she puts it. And I think readers will find it both alarming and fascinating how she espouses the anti-suffrage cause. But then there are also many men who come to Tennessee, to Nashville, to secretly work against the ratification. And those include corporate lobbyists. There's a lot of dark money in the anti-suffrage campaign. Wow. There are corporations that think women will be bad for their business if they're able to vote. And this includes actually the railroads. It includes the manufacturers because they're afraid that women voters will insist on abolishing child labor. And they depend upon that cheap labor. They don't want women being able to tell them what to do about that. The liquor industry also really funding anti-suffrage activities because they're afraid that women will want to enforce the prohibition laws, which are already in effect, but they don't want them enforced stringently, and they're afraid women will do that. Huh. So they're all pumping money. You know, this dark money is coming into the campaign, and in fact, the liquor industry sponsors something they call the Jack Daniel's Suite up in the hotel in Nashville, where they ply the legislators with liquor and try to convince them to vote against the amendment. Wow. So there's lots of interesting corporate opposition. Clergy, a lot of clergymen are against suffrage because they feel that this goes against God's plan. God, in their estimation, God made Adam to be dominant over Eve, and you know, Eve should just be at home and taking care of the children and not asking to vote. And they use biblical arguments to refute the idea of women's suffrage. And then the political parties are very nervous about women voting. This is 27 million women will be eligible to vote if Tennessee ratifies. This is a huge new voting bloc, and nobody knows how they're going to vote.
So what did happen when women finally got the right to vote? They voted in the 1920 election?
Yes. They were able, in most states, to vote in the 1920 election. In some states, the registration period had expired already by late August 1920, when the 19th Amendment enters the Constitution and becomes law. So some states extended their registration period to accommodate the women, but some, like Georgia, did not because they wanted to prevent black women from voting.
Wow.
And so they didn't allow any women to vote.
And that's when Warren Harding won.
Yes. And actually, women voted for Warren Harding. And part of that is that they were also rewarding the Republican Party for actually at that time, you have to kind of flip your frame of reference. The Republican Party was better about supporting suffrage than the Democrats had been.
Hmm. Yeah, things were sort of reversed back then in many ways. I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact that the anti-suffragists were the pro-booze people.
it was a little mixed on that. It was a little mixed. There are anti-suffragists who are also temperance supporters. But for other reasons, like the racist reasons and states' rights reasons, they're going to oppose suffrage.
Who was Harry Byrne?
Harry Byrne was the youngest member of the Tennessee legislature. He's only 24 years old. He's in his freshman term. He's up for re-election in the fall. And he comes from East Tennessee, which is traditionally a Republican enclave, even though Tennessee is usually a Democratic state. Two-thirds of the legislature is Democratic. In 1920, it's about a third Republican, and he's from that Republican area. He comes from a hilltop area called Niota, and pretty conservative. And he is under a lot of pressure about this ratification vote. Many of his constituents are against it, and his mentor, he's reading law under a distinguished lawyer in the area who's also a senator in the legislature, who is just a vociferous opponent of suffrage. And Harry does not want to cross him, and he doesn't want to jeopardize his reelection. And so he would just as soon, but personally, let me just say, personally, he actually does favor women's suffrage. He thinks it is by right that women should be able to have the same political rights as men. His widowed mother, is a very strong suffragist. She's very well educated. She reads all the newspapers and magazines. And she's home on the hilltop farm in Niota, and she's reading about Harry and in the legislature. And Harry puts on the red rose, which is the symbol of the anti-suffragists.
Right.
Sometimes this battle is called the War of the Roses because the belligerents wore emblems. The anti-suffragists wear an American beauty rose, and the suffrage supporters, ratification supporters, wear a yellow rose. And Harry's wearing a red rose. And he votes with the anti-suffragists on all the votes until the last.
And that's all you'll say. I was going to say, was his the deciding vote?
It is a deciding vote. There's a pressure on another legislator, but he wants to duck it. But in the end, it's that voice of conscience and his. His mother writes him a letter, and he's holding that letter. He's just received it. It's in his breast pocket.
Wow. Wow. So mm-hmm. there are a lot of names of people we don't know. How did you go about finding out about this final battle of the ratification of the 19th Amendment?
Well, it was fascinating. A lot of archival research. The Tennessee State Archives did a really great job of holding a lot of the material at the time, a lot of the letters that went back and forth, because it happens in Tennessee, but it's a national issue, and because this will change the law of the land. And so there's communication going back and forth with the White House. You have Woodrow Wilson, who is a lame duck president and is actually incapacitated at the time, and his wife is running the government, and his wife is an anti-suffragist.
Wow.
So that provides a very interesting dynamic, and there's lots of communication with the White House and between the political candidates and the participants in the fight in Nashville. Those are going back and forth, and I could find all those in the Tennessee State Archives. Then moving to the Library of Congress, I could find the papers of both the National American Association, which is the mainstream group, and the Women's Party. And there I could find a day-to-day report with all the letters going back and forth of what the organizers are doing in the field.
Wow.
And how they're maneuvering in the State House. And so I really get a very on-the-ground view of how they're handling the situation. So I'm able to describe that in a kind of you-are-there method, and I think it becomes very suspenseful because they don't know how it's going to turn out. The night before, the suffragists really think they're going to lose. It's that tight. And then the daily newspapers are very useful. The Schlesinger Library at Harvard is on the history of women. It's a wonderful resource of journals and memoirs of some of these suffrage women, and I use that extensively in their papers. So it was a lot of digging, To be able to build this narrative and show what really happened.
You know, here we are, it's 2018, and we still don't have an Equal Rights Amendment. Do you see the parallels between the fight for the 19th Amendment and an ERA?
Sure, and it's the same women in many respects, and I'll explain that. The Women's Party, Alice Paul, and her deputy, who's in Nashville, who's leading the fight for her in Nashville, the young third-generation suffragist Sue White, who's only 32 years old at the time, and she's leading the campaign for the Women's Party. She then returns to the Women's Party headquarters in Washington, and the Carrie Katz group, the National American Women's Suffrage Association, takes the tack that they are going to educate the newly enfranchised women. And so they establish the League of Women Voters. And that's where they put their energy. The Women's Party puts its energy into expanding women's rights beyond the vote. They say, okay, the vote is the first step. Now we need economic equality. We need equality in all other legal matters. We need equality in access to education and the professions. And in 1923, these same women who we've watched battle so hard to get the federal amendment approved, Sue White, Alice Paul, and then another legally trained woman named Crystal Eastman, write the Equal Rights Amendment. It is introduced into Congress in 1923, just 3 years after we get the vote.
Wow.
And you can count how many years it's been.
Yeah, it's been longer than the battle to get the 19th Amendment so far.
Yes, and these are the same women. So there's an absolutely straight line continuum. And of course, we see that it's possible to have a federal amendment that does not get ratified.
Yeah, and again, it came down to, I think, one state. I know I live in Florida. I believe if Florida had ratified it, we'd have the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yeah, so you know, that's kind of the story I'm telling in the Women's Hour.
It's amazing. And there are other parallels between those days, and we're coming up on the 100th anniversary, and you know, in many ways, the more things change, the more they stay the same. It seems. The book is called The Women's Hour: The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Elaine Weiss is on Twitter at EFWeiss5. Your website is ElaineWeiss.com, where you can find out a whole lot more about the book. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
For me, too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. So, fascinating book. I mean, it's written more like a novel. Like I said, I didn't get that far into it, but I was reading a bit of it yesterday at jury duty. And it, you know, it's amazing how much they did with so little. And I can also turn that around and say how little we're doing with so much more. All right, let's take one more break. We'll check out the Green News Report and come back with a little bit more for this Wednesday afternoon. I'm Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Even if you take the highest possible estimate of costs and the lowest possible estimate of benefits, benefits are still well over double what the costs were.
Trump doesn't want you to know his own report shows the benefits of environmental regulations far outweigh the costs. Colorado Republicans kill bill prioritizing public health in oil and gas development. Interior Secretary pulls lands in his own state from oil and gas auction. Plus,
it's just one after the other.
The third major storm in the Northeast in 10 days underscores the need to invest in electric grid resilience.
All of those needs and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
And we have 4 to 9 inches of global warming hoax piling up outside. Thanks, China.
Yep, thanks. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, I guess it's not unheard of, but man, this is the third nor'easter about to hit the East Coast in, what, a week or two?
Yes, in less than 2 weeks. And that is likely to bring even more power outages, even as hundreds of thousands of customers already remain without electricity after the previous two storms. Back-to-back storms, as you mentioned, are rare but not unheard of for the region. But the impacts, with little time for recovery in between, underscore what climate scientists have been warning about for years. Because of the documented increase in heavy precipitation events in the United States since 1950, we need to invest in infrastructure, like the electric grid. It needs to be hardened for resilience because of the increase in extreme weather events due to global warming.
And this isn't just back-to-back storms. This is back-to-back-to-back storms in the Northeast.
And intense ones at that.
Yep.
The benefits of regulations far outweigh their costs, as much as 7 times their cost, especially environmental regulations. That's the conclusion of a new report that was quietly released by President Trump's own Office of Management and Budget, which found that unequivocally, at a minimum, even when using the highest possible estimates of cost, major regulations like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act return more than double their cost in benefits to the American people. According to David Roberts of Vox on a recent broadcast, Trump's rollbacks of major environmental regulations to reduce compliance costs for corporations actually amount to a pollution tax of sorts on everyday Americans.
Air quality regulations are a downward redistribution of income. That's the right way to think about them. It's taking income out of corporate pockets and putting it into the pockets of average people who have to breathe the air. And the reverse, reversing or getting rid of these regulations, is an upward income redistribution. You're taking money out of the pockets of ordinary people in the form of health costs mm-hmm. and missed work and all the rest of it, and you're putting it in the pockets of industrialists.
So as it turns out, when Donald Trump and Scott Pruitt and these guys all say cutting regulations is good for the economy, turns out they're lying, and their own report from their own administration now shows it?
Yep.
Imagine that.
Meanwhile, in Colorado, after heavy lobbying from the oil and gas industry, Republican lawmakers in the state legislature last week killed proposed legislation that would have required Colorado state regulators of the oil and gas industry to prioritize public safety and to treat protection of public health and the environment as a precondition before allowing further encroachment of drilling operations inside city limits and near homes and schools.
Well, we'd hate to do that.
In Utah, in the fight to save Bears Ears National Monument, Internal Interior Department emails obtained in a lawsuit by the New York Times show that oil and gas were the primary motivation behind the Trump administration's decision to shrink the monument. The Trump administration had claimed early last year that its so-called monument review had no predetermined outcomes, but the internal documents tell a different story, showing that long before the review was launched, Interior Department officials were primarily focused on oil and gas exploration. Native American tribes have vowed to sue over Trump's plans to cut nearly 90% of the monument in southeastern Utah. Finally, some good news, at least for folks in Montana. Speaking of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, he has unexpectedly withdrawn more than 17,000 acres of the public's lands from consideration for an auction of leases to the oil and natural gas industry. Local and national environmental groups had tried to stop the sale, arguing drilling in these areas would harm the Yellowstone River and other sensitive regions. Zinke said that the department needed to study the area more before putting it up for auction. I'm sure it's purely coincidental that the protected lands happen to be located in Zinke's home state,
where he's planning to run for governor. So he takes all this public land out of our national park so that it can be sold, given away to oil and gas interests. But in his own home state, he protects public land from those very same oil and gas interests.
Funny that.
For much more on all of these reports and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
boy, did I mess up on my timing. It could be because the guest called in late. I'll let that be the excuse. So tomorrow on the show, we'll go through the rest of this White House exodus. We'll talk about who's leaving, who's coming, elections, Howie Klein's here because tomorrow's Thursday. So thank you for that. Thank you for your patience and bearing with me yesterday on my jury duty day. Sometimes, you know, you got no control over the situation. And other times you screw up on the timing. Just keep an eye out. Larry Kudlow is coming from CNBC to replace, Gary Cohn as the chief economic advisor for the White House. Unbelievable. Never a dull moment, though. All right. As always, thank you for listening. Tomorrow, Howie Klein Day here on The Nicole Sandler Show at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network. Thank you for listening.